Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Big Ideas. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we interview an author with a big idea, and we ask them what it's about, and we analyze it and test it and talk about it so that you can understand it as well. Today, I'm happy to say on our inaugural podcast, we have Alec Foge on the show, and we'll be talking about his big idea book, The Tinkerers, The Amateurs, DIYers, and Inventors Who Make America Great. So, Alec, kick it off for us by telling us what the big idea is.
Well, Marshall, thank you for having me on your inaugural Big Ideas show. The big idea behind my book, The Tinkerers, is that there's an American tinkering spirit that we often hear about, and the book tries to figure out whether this spirit is still alive, and if so, how vibrant is it, and if it needs amplifying, what kinds of things can we do to encourage it and help it grow further? I guess the provocative part of the idea behind the book is that I define tinkering fairly specifically, and I say that in the book that tinkerers, by my definition, are actually dilettantes. And I mean that in a positive way. They're not specialists. And I think that in our current era, we've come to think of people who invent things and innovate as trained engineers or people who have a deep understanding of the high-tech gadgetry that surrounds us these days. And therefore, the average person can no longer be a tinkerer. And I argue that that simply is not true, and in fact that people who tinker, and this has been true historically in this country, do so without a really clear purpose in mind, and that's why it works so well. And in fact, most of the great innovations in American history have typically come from people who thought they were trying to invent one thing and ended up solving quite a different problem. And so in the end, therefore, we as a society cannot necessarily systematize tinkering and innovation, but rather the best that we can do is create the most hospitable environments for allowing tinkerers to do their thing and essentially be there at the ready for when they're mature enough to be developed into something else, whether it's a product or an innovation or even just an idea that might transform our society. And I think as a culture in recent decades, for a variety of reasons, I think the main one is concerns over employment. Americans have artificially separated the arts and the sciences. You know, you have this idea either you're somebody who has a knack for technology or math, or you're somebody who is much more humanities oriented, and therefore you might become a teacher or God forbid, a writer. and we've had that filter down into the way we direct young people into higher education and into occupations. And I think that's a bit of a mistake. And most of the contemporary tinkerers that I spoke to for my book argue quite to the contrary and say, you know, they've always been all about both the arts and the sciences. And so, you know, that sort of has given them the framework for whatever it is they sought out to do and what they ultimately did. And I may be a little bit biased. I had a liberal arts education myself and was always somebody who kind of, had an interest both in science and in arts and humanities. But I was really, that was one of the astonishing things and helped me really sharpen my focus in the book was talking to some pretty prominent people, some of whom are known in science and technology fields, who also are impassioned about other types of pursuits in the arts, whether it's crafts or cooking or music. And I think there's a big driver underneath that sort of worldview, and that is the fact that most tinkerers become accustomed to failure very early on, and they learn that they have to work through the failure, and oftentimes many multiples of failures before they happen upon the thing that ultimately is successful for them or transforming. And part of that takes a kind of ability to see the big picture in the world, and that comes with having all different kinds of experiences. And I think that all of the contemporary tinkerers I talked to had those kind of formative experiences early on in their lives. And in that sense, I realized that the American tinkering spirit is in no way dead. It's just that in certain areas, it's become a little dormant or stunted just because of some other things that we in this country happen to do very well, such as capitalism and building large corporations. And while corporations have provided a lot of environments for innovators over the decades, they've also kind of quashed a lot of innovation and tinkering just by doing what they do. And I talk a lot about that in the book, about the contrast between capitalism and creativity. Mm-hmm. And how if done right, some really great things can happen, and if done wrong, it kind of snuffs out some really great ideas.
Mm-hmm. I think when most people consider tinkering, they think of guys and gals, if I can so speak, in their garages building things. So let's draw a very sharp distinction, just for illustrative purposes, between tinkering and engineering. What is the difference between tinkering and engineering? Just stick to the realm of physical technology. I don't want to imply that you can't tinker in organizations or in business or in sports or in lots of other things, because you can. But let's just talk about technology for a second. What's the difference between engineering and tinkering?
Well, I mean, they're certainly interrelated. I mean, engineering in modern times has obviously become a profession that requires a particular sort of academic degree. And learning, depending what kind of engineering you're talking about, a particular set of skills. Tinkering can certainly be a part of that. And I've spoken to, even in the course of doing press for my book, to a lot of trained engineers who, in their spare time, do an awful lot of tinkering. And so there, I guess, is probably the inflection point of where they depart, because as an engineer, one may have in a work environment some very specific problems to solve, whereas whatever that tinkerer does in their basement or garage is something that is just that their own curiosity kind of guides. And one of the things I also highlight is the kind of personal passion that is always driven pure tinkerers to the point that they wade into stuff. I mean, I think we forget when there's so many newfangled new gadgets that we experience these days that we forget that everything that is new is built out of something old.
Mm.
So really, and the economist Paul Romer, I quote in a book, talks about this a fair bit, about how tinkering is really just taking what's around you in the world and reassembling it.
Mm-hmm.
in a way that seems novel or hasn't been done quite that way before. And there's one great analogy of course, semiconductors are really just bits of sand assembled in a certain mm-hmm. way that creates new meaning. So nothing is new and everything is old, but within that, with that knowledge can come an awful lot of innovation nonetheless. So mm-hmm. I think that I can go into some examples from
sure, go ahead.
In the book. One story I like from the book is, obviously Thomas Edison is probably the world's best known inventor, and certainly Thomas Edison was a tinkerer. You know, the famous image of Thomas Edison, which was kind of enhanced even during his lifetime by the press, of being, the Wizard of Menlo Park. The great man in his laboratory with his teams of assistants, and he would come up with some, great theoretical solution to a problem, and then all his employees would toil for hours and hours and night after night trying to figure out just the right combination of parts and elements to put together to make, a better light bulb or whatever was at hand. But I tell the story in the book of his development of the first phonograph, and how Edison, even though he was already very successful, could never envision for many years the phonograph as anything but an office machine. He envisioned it as a dictation machine that would be very useful in office situations. Even after some music had been recorded, he couldn't imagine that people would buy these things as entertainment devices.
Mm-hmm.
And he struggled with this for decades, and it impacted a lot of his the way he was trying to innovate in with the phonograph and how it developed. And in fact, in the end, other companies, one in fact that included Alexander Graham Bell as a partner, ultimately developed the phonograph that we know in the modern sense, as one that plays flat discs. I mean, obviously now we don't have those anymore, but for anybody who can remember vinyl albums, I mean, that was not something that Edison ever was really able to wrap his head around, and in fact, as a result, never really was able to capitalize on his invention. And so I guess I argue in the book that if Edison had so much trouble over so many years trying to tinker and evolve, into what he was doing with the phonograph, then certainly others shouldn't feel so badly about having trouble with their own efforts. Tinkering, genuine tinkering, I think, takes time and it takes persistence and it takes, a certain level of confidence and self-reliance
mm-hmm.
that relates to coping with failure
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
and multiple failures.
We'll give some more examples in a second because you have a lot of them in the book and they're terrific. But before we go on, I want to harken back to something I mentioned in the pre-interview to you, and that is ambiguity. I told you I went to a corporation to work once, and I worked there, and they told me I had to have a comfort with ambiguity. It seems that's an important part of tinkering as well.
Absolutely. I think that, I come up with a number of examples of institutionalized tinkering from the latter part of the the 20th century going into the early 21st century, and sort of how some of them went right to a certain degree, but how many of them ultimately went wrong. You know, one of the best examples, I think, is Xerox PARC Corporation, which famously, you know, was kind of this freewheeling environment out in Palo Alto, California, where there was a lot of free time to come up with new ideas, potentially for the Xerox Corporation to capitalize on. And, of course, they famously came up with probably the earliest personal computer, the Alto, which had a computer mouse and had, you know, Windows-like, you know, structures on its interface. And but the folks back in Stamford, Connecticut, where Xerox is based at the time, just didn't see any value in it. And it was only when a young entrepreneur named Steve Jobs came along and demanded to get a tour of their facility and see what was going on there that that he was able to walk away with those basic ideas and develop the first Apple computer. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not just about coming up with the great ideas, especially in a corporate setting. It's being able to have a corporate structure that allows for that kind of ambiguity and that allows investment in activities that may or may not result in revenue. Mm-hmm. I think in the decades since that era, you know, despite the fact that obviously we've had a lot of innovative companies in this country and all sorts of wonderful things have developed, it still seems like that big corporations have a lot of trouble with this concept. And you know, one of the most best contemporary examples is Google, ironically a very innovative corporation that became known early on in its history for what it called its 20% time, which the basic idea was that they wanted employees to spend 20% of their time at work working on projects that had nothing to do with their job title, and to come up with new ideas and to develop those ideas. And in the early years, it seemed to work quite well. Apparently, Gmail and Google News and AdSense, one of their early ad programs, came out of that 20% time. But the word is, in recent years, as the, you know, now obviously Google is a huge corporation, and it's been harder and harder for them to justify to both to shareholders and to, you know, in internal managers devoting that sort of free time to unclear purposes. So in recent months, word has come out that now apparently you need managerial approval for a lot of the projects being developed in 20% time, and you know, they've had trouble retaining some of their top talent because a lot of those folks are intrigued by smaller, you know, more faster moving companies that are doing the kinds of things that helped establish Google in the beginning. So it's a problem that even at the most innovative companies, there continues to be a struggle with that kind of ambiguity, even, you know, even as it's, as, you know, they build upon those original innovations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. One of the things you mentioned in the book, you also mentioned it in the interview, is that many things that we think of as innovations that come of tinkering, I would even say almost all of them, are the result of the recombination of things that already exist.
Right.
I just think that's totally true. Can you give some examples of that?
Well, you know, I guess one example would be you want a contemporary example?
Yeah, a contemporary example would be great.
Well, I think, you know, one good example, you know, well, let me start with a little story about Dean Kamen, the inventor of this Segway transporter,
yeah.
which was an interesting invention in itself. You know, people now, you mostly see them around these days when people are giving sort of guided outdoor tours, or I know that in large warehouses, I think in Amazon's warehouses, they use them to get quickly across a very large warehouse floor. But, you know, as Dean Kamen, who's a serial tinkerer and inventor, imagined it originally, it was going to be the vehicle of the future. It, you know, the Segway operates on a gyroscopic principle that he actually originally developed for a walking wheelchair that was supposed to allow people to who are wheelchair bound to climb stairs and cross the street and get up onto to high curbs and eventually evolved into this mysterious device that was sort of announced with a lot of excitement. And I joke, you know, in the book that unfortunately very quickly after it was introduced, it became kind of a punchline. There's a sort of silly movie that had the comedian Kevin James in it called Paul Blart Mall Cop.
Yeah.
And a running joke in it is that he you know, races around a mall on a Segway, and of course how undignified and unserious that is. And, you know, so that kind of thing became unfortunate, and it became even more unfortunate after, in a freak accident, the CEO of the company that was marketing this Segway was killed after he accidentally drove a Segway off a cliff. Mm. So, which is obviously a very horrific and sad accident, but it didn't help the image of the Segway. My point of that story, I guess, is that, you know, in the end, I think people looked at Dean Kamen's invention as something that just was ridiculous. But what's interesting now is that technology, I think, and there have been a number of people who have pointed this out, may come into play even in the future of electric cars, for example. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, he may have just been too early in his time, that technology, you know, it started out in these walking wheelchairs and it went into the Segway, but, you know, the technology itself was pretty brilliant. And, you know, I think that, you know, in talking to Dean Kamen, he seems to understand that. I mean, what's interesting is he was kind of a prodigy tinkerer himself, and at a very young age invented a very ingenious insulin pump that freed diabetics from being tied into, especially if they were homebound, being tied into having to get all these shots all the time. It was able to self-regulate the insulin. Mm-hmm. And went on to invent all sorts of medical pumps that were fairly revolutionary. And actually, that's where he made his original fortune. So, you know, there's this notion I think we have this image that cool new inventions just come whole, whole and of a piece out of somebody's brain, and there they are, and they change the world. But the reality is that for most tinkerers, these things get played with over time and all sorts of iterations over time. And ultimately, you know, it's hard to say sometimes where they're going to reach their fullest potential.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think that in a corporate environment, this is only my opinion, but doesn't Apple basically live and die on this stuff because they take components and ideas from other places, recombine them, and then brilliantly kind of sell them to everybody? I mean, I occasionally come out with a prototype of some sort that fails, but it seems to me that much of what the Apple Corporation makes is the result of the recombination and reengineering of things that already exist.
I think that's true. I mean, when you look at, the products that have been so huge for them, they never invented any of those things themselves. They kind of perfected them. And, you know, I guess I do have a little bit of tinkering lore about Steve Jobs in the book, but ultimately, you know, you could probably argue he was more of a design genius than a supreme marketer than a tinkerer per se. I mean, he certainly wasn't usually in there getting his hands dirty. That was in the early days. That was Steve Wozniak's job. Mm-hmm. But I think you're right, and it's funny because I have. As somebody who started out as a PC guy early in my career and slowly and slowly have found more Apple devices in my home, I have mixed feelings about them. I think Apple makes terrific devices, and You know, they're very forward thinking in terms of how to take existing technologies and sort of make them almost more humanistic and more intrinsic to how people actually think and operate. But on the other hand, Apple, in, you know, for example, in the hacker community, Apple is kind of reviled because so many of their devices are so difficult to get into. Mm-hmm. And that's what people who get excited about computers love to do. They like to get inside and, you know, most PCs, you can switch out all the components and you can really, you can build your own. I mean, there's, that's kind of the, most of the history of personal computers. And yet most Apple devices come, pretty much sealed up and hard to, hard to break into. I mean, certainly people have succeeded in doing it, but they've been very hacker and tinkerer unfriendly in a lot of ways, which is ironic considering their roots. But that's a whole other conversation.
It is ironic because if I know a little bit about the Homebrew Computer Club, the history of the organization out of which Apple emerged, and Wozniak and Jobs were there. They were buying components from computer makers and then putting them together, a little bit like people in a previous generation would buy auto parts and trick out cars.
Yep.
They weren't inventing anything. They were putting them together in different ways.
Right.
And well, in really creative ways.
I think it's funny because, I mean, we live in a very individual-oriented culture and we're very achievement-oriented. And so there's always sort of this drive to kind of give credit where credit is due, when in fact you look at a lot of these environments that so many innovations have come out over the years, you know, in a corporate setting, and typically there are teams of people working on things. There may be real individual insights that are kind of provide breakthrough moments, but you know, typically if you know, a fair number of contemporary tinkerers I spoke to said that their preferred tinkering environment was kind of with a few very trusted colleagues, you know, sort of just bouncing ideas off of each other and seeing what sticks, essentially.
I mean, it's interesting you mentioned that because in the same corporation where I worked, they did a lot of brainstorming, and I had come from an academic world where that never happens. Never, ever. And especially in the humanities and social sciences, there's almost no collaboration whatsoever.
Right.
When I was a historian, we never collaborated with anybody. And so I was very skeptical of brainstorming when I first saw it and kind of dismissive of it. And then after a couple of months, I basically had to admit that it worked.
Yeah.
We came up with things that it never would have occurred to me that you could do this thing. And brainstorming actually, if it's structured correctly, really does produce new ideas. And I think it's precisely because you have a lot of people who have different experiences in the room. They can speak freely. They're not afraid of censure. And, you know, they kind of have that comfort with ambiguity. They don't know exactly what they want yet, and they're willing to go forward with it. And, you know, I found it actually kind of marvelously productive for new ideas in this particular corporate environment. And you know, the corporation is an inventive one, so they do stuff like that. Yeah. Let me ask you this. How could a corporation, if it wanted to, build a culture in which tinkering was encouraged? I'm going to segue into a conversation of how this is impossible in academia. I'll just show my cards. But how would a corporation do it?
Well, I think there are a number of ways that it could be done in a corporate setting. None of them are particularly easy. You know, one way in which corporations more recently have tried to do this is sort of acknowledge that maybe innovation can't be fostered in the way that it might be at a startup in-house, and so they'll partner with smaller companies that are very innovative and essentially try to you know, give them the sort of financial incentives they need, but let it happen externally and then kind of try to figure out ways to reap the benefits internally. I know Procter & Gamble has had a program for a while where they try to do that. Another way to do it, which is probably a little more radical, is to have a company in which employees are essentially allowed to own their innovations. And, you know, and the businesses where they are developed essentially make arrangements where they have first refusal of any resulting business. I guess that's a little more provocative because most companies would argue that, well, if we're providing all the time and resources to enable your, you know, your tinkering, then we should own it. You know, we certainly want to make the most of it. But the reality is that that so rarely works. And in fact, there are all sorts of examples of you know, talented tinkerers who, you know, confronted with that sort of proposition, ultimately just leave their companies and start their own companies to do what they want to do. And so maybe it's not as outlandish as it sounds. I mean, I found a recently heard about a small company in Toronto, a software development company that does that. Again, it's a small company. It's not a large one. But, you know, these there are probably some other ways to, you know, within corporations to create what really has to be a space of creative anarchy in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And I think when people hear that term anarchy, they get kind of nervous. Mm-hmm. And certainly, you know, these days, public corporations are probably the least likely places where that those kinds of environments are likely to crop up, in part because obviously you have to answer to shareholders and you have quarterly earnings reports and, you know, this kind of activity just doesn't fit in very well, mm-hmm. especially if you're investing any sort of meaningful amount of capital into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the time horizon for these places is very short. Once you go public, you really can't look. You can't say, for example, okay, we're going to buy all of IBM's patents for $20 billion, and we're just going to look through them. We're going to see what's there. And companies do this pretty commonly. They do buy these stocks of patents just because they think there's something of value in there, but the shareholders are not going to like that.
Right. Yeah, and I think that, you know, what's changed in recent years, you know, I think there's people know now, I mean, it's happened so much in the past few decades that innovation and change have to happen. It's just that, so people, you know, managers at large companies tend to say the right things these days, and there are lots of kinds of you know, new structures that are being tried out, like, you know, some companies have hack days or hackathons, you know, where they essentially, I joke that it's sort of the, you know, the modern equivalent of what used to be known as the corporate retreat.
Where, right, know, the corporate
get
retreat.
Get together and, you know, sing songs together and throw around a medicine ball.
Yeah.
And,
Kumbaya and trust falls.
Right, and, you know, anybody who's ever been through one of those activities know how dreadful they can be. And, you know, and the fact of the matter is that, you know, at a lot of large corporations, and this isn't to denigrate, you know, the employees of those companies, it's just that a lot of the folks at those companies are there because these are large, stable companies where, you know, presumably if you do your job, then, you know, and you get your paycheck. And so this idea that they have to do this larger, you know, extra curricular kind of brainstorming is terrifying a lot of people. It's kind of like, well, I got enough deadlines already. I got to come up with some, you know, idea that's going to make the country, make the company, you know, millions of dollars. You know, I don't have time for it. I got to get home to the kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's something about those sort of corporate environments, I think, that kind of runs counter to the types of people who typically, you know, are these transforming tinkerers. But I think that, you know, on one hand, everybody is not an entrepreneur. Everybody is not a grand innovator. You know, there's certainly a small group of people, I think, in society ultimately who come up with some of the really big ideas. But that doesn't mean that taking a tinkering approach to what you have at hand isn't of value. And I think that in a society like ours where, you know, we're seeing so many rapid transformations in almost every industry these days, it seems like, that, you know, I think that more and more people are realizing that that even at the level of large corporations, that there is no more business as usual. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, even if you're not the person who's going to come up with the next billion-dollar idea, there are ways to think about that kind of changing around all of the elements in your life, you know, or at least rearranging them can be of value once in a while.
Mm-hmm. And this does provide a nice segue into something you talk about near the end of the book, and something I know about from personal experience, and that is the educational system in the United States. You're right. I think that corporations have gotten the news about tinkers and innovation. It seems to me that people in the educational industry, if we can call it that, I'm sure they would hate it, have not gotten the news about it.
Well, I think that, you know, there, unfortunately, over time, you know, there's become a very test score oriented approach to education in this country. You know, of course, we're a very competitive culture, and, you know, but, you know, in the efforts to raise the overall quality of education, I think, unfortunately, we've become too focused on test scores, and you see so many teachers teaching to the test these days. And when students apply to college, the focus is very much on test scores and, mm-hmm. You know, and grades, which, you know, I think that all of those play a role. But I think that, as we all know, once you get into the real world, all of those skills don't really help that much.
No, they really don't. And I would tell my students this all the time when they would talk to me about grades. Grades on the college level are next to useless now because of grade inflation. And, right. You know, when you get into a corporation or you get into an actual business, it really the question is, what can you do?
Right.
And if you can do something of value and something that I didn't expect I needed done, but you could do that, that's really something you would want to have, because then you can actually present something of value to your employer. I mean, I guess one of the things that occurs to me, and I wanted to hear what you thought about it, is that especially in college, you mentioned that there's a certain amount of professionalization. It's kind of professional creep. So it was the case that when you went to a big university, a land-grant university or something, you basically majored in the liberal arts. But now there are all these other tracks you can go into. You can go into engineering, you can go into business, pre-dentistry. That was right. One that I can't encountered. And liberal arts, I think, suffers there. Could you talk a little bit about the result of that, or what do you think about that?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, I understand where some of it comes from. I mean, we've been through a very frightening economic crisis that, you know, we're still kind of coming out of. And the cost of higher education has skyrocketed to these astronomical levels. And so, you know, there's been a lot of talk in recent years about the, what is the value of a college education? And, you know, some experts will say, well, you better know what your end goal is, i.e. what job you're going to get with this education before you even begin it, you know, and what is the return on investment on that tuition? And, you know, I understand that perspective. I don't happen to agree with it. I think that it's sort of answering the wrong question in a weird way. I understand that people are concerned about employment, and certainly the job market these days is very challenging. But even the presumption that you would know as a student beginning college what it is, never mind what it is you want to do in your career, but the idea that actually is what you will do, and that you will do that the rest of your life, the rest of your working life, is sort of becoming an erroneous concept. Because, of course, these days, you know, it's not like most people get a job with a corporation, work for that corporation for 35 years and retire. That's just not happening as much anymore. Typically, people are changing careers, you know, once, twice, many more times than that. And, you know, so the idea that you would have this particular skill, and it's not to take away from the value of some of those skills. I would never recommend somebody who wanted to be a doctor to tinker their way into that field, you know, I think you should probably go to medical school.
Yeah.
You know, not to say that you couldn't be an innovator on the other end of that once certain things are in place, but, you know, I think the point is to sort of, and again, I may be a little biased because I am a product of a liberal arts education, you know, you kind of have to have a good sense of what's out there and what's going on in the world to properly make those decisions. And, you know, one of the strongest tools I think the United States still has in the world of innovation is we have a very superb graduate education system in place. I think that, you know, you still see many top students from around the world coming to the United States for their graduate education. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that is evidence that, you know, there is something that we do get right at that top level, and understanding some of the things, the pieces that need to go into that type of education. One intriguing thing that I mention in the book is an institute that was founded at Stanford University in 2005, that called the Hasso-Plattner Institute of Design, and they have a non-degree program there known as the B-School. And the basic idea is to teach students from all of the graduate schools at Stanford how to embrace ambiguity, experimentation, and the possibility of failure. And they have all different kinds of activities that they actually require, I believe, students from some of the various graduate schools to participate in to essentially unlearn a lot of that test-taking mentality that got them to Stanford in the mm-hmm. first place mm-hmm. with this, you know, clear belief that, you know, the world is different now, and if we want to stay competitive worldwide, you know, it's not about being the smartest person in the room. It's about being nimble and open to change and ready for failure and, you know, ready to kind of push on to the next thing. The ironic thing about that is I think those are sort of core American principles that kind of got us where we, you know, it got us to be the big nation that we ultimately have become.
Mm-hmm. You quote Tocqueville in the book, and I will read pretty much any book that quotes Tocqueville. I have to tell you, that is the mark of a good book.
I'll keep that in mind in the future.
That is the mark of a good book. And about if you're writing about the United States and you don't quote Tocqueville, well, you really have made a mistake. So
yeah,
I think that's true. So where do you see all this headed? I mean, do you think that there is a great future for tinkers in America, or are you going to make some dire predictions? Or
I'm pretty upbeat about it. And I would say the main reason is because of some things that have been going on in the past few years that really are quite remarkable. One of the things is the growing popularity of the maker fairs. I don't know if you've ever been to one of these.
I haven't been to one, but I know about them, and I love the idea.
Yeah, they're terrific. I just went to a really large one in New York City a few months back, and took the whole family, and we had a blast. I mean, just hundreds and hundreds of booths, some of which were inhabited by scientists or technologists or artists, craftspeople, musicians, just an astonishing array of activities. And, you know, some people had finished products they were trying to market. Others weren't quite sure what they were doing. I remember talking to a guy who had come up with this technology. Essentially what he would do is he would take old manual typewriters, and he had a whole interface that he put together where he could hook them up to an iMac, and so you could type on an old-fashioned manual keyboard, and use it as your keyboard for the computer. I just loved it. I mean, I don't know what its ultimate purpose was other than just as a novelty. But it was the epitome to me of kind of where tinkering can lead you. Mm-hmm. Sometimes just to these sort of, you know, kind of punchlines, these existential punchlines. And but there were all sorts of great things there. And one of the things that I mean, I have young kids. I have a 10-year-old and a 7-year-old. And you know, you take kids to an event like this, and you don't need to explain to them what to do.
Mm-hmm.
They just walk up to a table and start taking something apart or putting it back together then or asking questions about it. And you realize that, you know, tinkering is something that's innate. I think kids do it automatically. The trick is how in our society do we foster, foster that tinkering and encourage it and not squash that impulse, which I think we inadvertently do with a lot of our, what we do in education sometimes. I also look to some other things, like there are these innovation engines or companies online, like Kickstarter mm-hmm. is probably the most prominent one, where essentially people are crowdsourcing their tinkering projects. So, your idea online on the Kickstarter site, and then other people can actually donate small, you put a amount of money up there that you're trying to raise to finish your project, and then people kind of weigh in and they can comment on your project, they can donate small amounts of money, and once you get to the point where you reach that amount that you've requested, then you can actually go forward with your project. And I think I love that kind of idea, and there are certainly some other companies out there doing it as well. What I love about it is it sort of ties in the whole history of tinkering and American tinkering, but it sort of adds an element that wasn't even possible to add, just a decade ago or so, where you can get virtual strangers to kind of walk by and say, oh, well, that's interesting, but have you thought about this?
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, but you get the pure power of the marketplace. You get people who are willing to put up a little bit of their own money for usually what it is a small, token of appreciation, or if it's an art project, you might, for example, some people have funded, music albums that they wanted to record, and every contributor will get a free copy of the album when it's done.
Mm-hmm.
There are all sorts of innovative ways to structure the financing, but I think that when I see things like that, I realize, this stuff is all alive, and we're seeing the green shoots of a whole new generation of tinkering, and in fact, some of those fears may be premature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have to say this. When I was a kid, my favorite toy was the Tinker toy. And they're still around. I know my son plays with them. So, and I just used to love to build things. I didn't exactly know what they were, but I would build them and I'd say, look at this, Mom. And she's like, what is that? I said, I don't know. But it's kind of cool, isn't it? Look, it turns.
Right. And look, even Legos are more popular than ever. And,
Legos have gotten bizarre. I mean, they're bizarrely complicated now. They are.
Some people will criticize the fact that they've gone towards these very structured kits where you're supposed to build a specific thing. But, I think the basic, the prevalence of them, the reality is I know from my own family experience that typically you'll have a playroom just with a whole layer of Legos sprawled across it.
Yeah.
And
come to my house.
Some sort of device or vehicle or something comes out of it.
Yeah. No, you should come to my house. It's exactly what it is. So,
right.
Well, I'm glad to hear you're optimistic about it. I am optimistic about it too. As I told you in the pre-interview, the New Books Network, on which this show, New Books and Big Ideas, is hosted, was a kind of tinkering project of mine. I was working in this corporation and I had this idea that I could interview smart people with good books, and that people would listen to the podcast and the publishers would get on board, and that I could figure out how to record things and record the audio and that kind of thing and edit it. And lo and behold, it worked. And we're even on Kickstarter. We haven't been Kickstarted yet. So if anybody's listening that wants to kickstart us, I think that would be great. But I can tell you from my perspective, my tinkering project, which is the New Books Network and those who work on it, there are about 50 of us, we already consider it a success. I mean, we haven't made any money. It costs us money. But, we reach a lot of people with these interviews, people like you, Alec. And so in a certain weird way, the project itself was its own reward. I don't need to be paid to do it.
I think that's important. There's something about American tinkering in particular, that is about self-actuation and self-reliance.
Yeah.
And there is a real power and confidence that comes out of having an idea in your head and then realizing it. And, you know, and that's quite apart from any financial reward or anything.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, I know as a book author, I have the same sort same sort of impulses. So it's
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And I should also say that it fits the pattern because I had a number of ideas for web projects that would disseminate serious ideas and, well, they failed. But I'll tell you what, in every single one of them, I learned a lot.
Yeah.
And they all went into the New Books Network. Everything I learned went into the New Books Network. And if you want to hear something that's kind of a quasi failure, you should listen to some of my early interviews on New Books in History a few years ago.
Okay.
Before I knew what I was doing. But I think the audience has been very gracious in continuing to listen to me. And I think the audience will be gracious as well in buying your book. We've been talking with Alec Foge about his book, The Tinkerers, The Amateurs, DIYers, and Inventors Who Make America Great. Alec, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Marshall, thanks for having me. It was a real pleasure.
All right, great. Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.